Hello once again. Welcome back to Vox Pop, WAMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Ray Graff. Today we convene the Science Forum. And my God, what a brilliant batch of scientists we have today. I've never seen smarter-looking scientists. I don't recognize any of them, but we'll get to know them in a minute. The number to call is 800-348-2551. 800-348-2551. You can also email us, voxpop@wamc.org. But the number, once again, is 800-348-2551. Brilliant scientists all. We have three here, and aren't we lucky? Scientists, sign in, please.
Ed Stander, SUNY Cobleskill. I teach geology, astronomy, environmental science, and anything Barbara can't.
Oh, you've been on the show before?
Twice.
Okay, all right, fine.
On the same day.
I'm Jim Pickett. I'm an organic chemist and recently retired.
Well, welcome back.
Good for you, Jim. I'm Barbara Brabets. I teach at SUNY Cobleskill and grade papers when I'm not there.
So you're a little tired, right? Finals week?
It's okay. I got this.
Yeah?
It's like my 52nd semester in college, so I'm okay.
Ed looks pretty relaxed. I don't think he's doing much.
He's on sabbatical.
I'm on sabbatical.
That's why you're tanned, rested, and fit today, eh?
Yeah.
Well, on top of that, my students are doing extremely well this year.
Really?
Oh, yeah. Not one of them has failed.
Very interesting. And Jim, you're just very relaxed all the time, right?
Well, I'd still work a little on the side.
But, okay. Yeah. All right. Work when you want to.
Well, I have to. I'm working my kid's way through college.
And the number, once again, is 800-348-2551. Before we go to the calls, anybody have anything scientific they want to say?
Well, there was a little dot that went across the sun the other day.
Oh, Mercury, yeah.
And Ed was good enough to pull out the solar telescope at school and give us all a chance to go out and see that bright blue light. Yeah, that's how.
Bright blue light?
Bright blue light. The bright. Stop it.
You're tired.
Yeah, the bright yellow light up in the sky and see that little dot on the sun. It was really quite cool.
So the solar telescope, it just filters all the stuff that will make you blind?
Yes. Okay. And leaves a little black dot so you could see it.
Mercury is very, very, very small compared to the sun, so it must not have been a really tremendous show.
No, but what was really cool is that there were a couple prominences of the sun at the same time, so you can get an idea how big these solar flares were compared to the dot.
The little dot Mercury. That went across. Yeah.
They were much bigger than that planet.
Yeah, my son and I watched it, too. He had a telescope with a solar filter. We'd also seen the transit of Venus a few years ago.
Which is more impressive.
Yeah, the Mercury really is just a little dot.
Yeah.
Although it was surprisingly easy to see.
It's a nice freckle.
Low magnification.
A mole, really.
Well, but I think Venus is the mole and Mercury is the freckle.
Yeah. Or a mouse.
Yeah, with Mercury, it looked as if someone had taken a paper punch and just punched a hole out of the sun. It was remarkable.
I like that. Okay, now we had a call on line one about inertia, but fittingly, the call is now no longer there. So let's go to line three, and we'll start with Philip in Amsterdam. Philip, you're on the Science Forum. Lucky you.
Hi. Could you discuss the difference between matter and antimatter? And I just recently read that gravitational waves, left-handed orientational gravitational waves react with matter, and right-handed gravitational waves react with antimatter. I have no idea what all that means, but, you know, maybe start with what is the difference between matter and antimatter. I'll hang up, okay?
Okay, you got it. All right, so we'll send this one to the physicist.
Yeah.
We don't have a physicist. That means it's Ed's question.
Well, matter is, the best way to look at matter and antimatter is that matter is electrons and antimatter are positrons.
Okay.
And effectively, at the beginning of the universe, when the Big Bang occurred, or the Big Non-Bang, since it was quiet at the time, when it occurred, it produced matter and antimatter, both electrons and positrons. And when an electron meets a positron, it effectively extinguishes itself, produces a little bit of light, and what's called a neutrino. So that's basically what we know about it. And luckily, apparently, at the beginning of the universe, there were a couple more electrons than there were positrons, which is why the universe is made up of matter rather than antimatter.
Anybody else want to weigh in?
And it goes beyond just electrons.
Right.
All the particles have their anti-equivalent. And why they should be there, I have no idea.
There's a lot science doesn't know about a lot of things.
Yeah. Especially the large stuff.
Yeah.
Or the fundamental stuff.
The important
stuff
things.
You can't see.
Why are we here?
But I'm still laughing inside about the joke about, does anyone want to weigh in about antimatter and matter? Thanks, Ray.
Thanks very much.
Yeah.
And to the gravitational wave interactions, I have not read anything about that.
Well, we just confirmed their existence recently, right?
Yeah, I didn't know that there was a polarization and
right, a handedness to it.
I'm actually kind of skeptical about that.
One of the only things I can say about that is that there are scientists who think that the gravitational waves are produced because of matter and antimatter interactions.
Ah.
Now, beyond that, I can't really say what the effect would be.
It's the Science Forum on Vox Pop. 800-348-2551 is the number. And lo and behold, the call about inertia is now back.
Let's that go to happens.
Peggy in Queamans Hollow. Peggy, you're on.
Hi. Sorry, I was cut off. I got a busy signal before.
Ouch.
But I found that, and this question is about a shopping cart and a corral. If I move a shopping cart into a corral that is on a slight incline and stop it, it stays there. However, if I give it if I'm moving into that same corral with a slight push, it moves forward and then moves immediately back. But I'm assuming that before moving forward and before moving back, it comes to at least a brief halt. So why doesn't the inertia stop it from moving backwards as it does when it's totally stopped?
So is it hitting the back of the corral, or
no,
is it kind of
not
doing a boomerang?
Yeah, if it were hitting anything, that would make a difference. But no, it's not. So, I've noticed this a few times, and it just seems funny because, as I said, I can't imagine that inertia has a time factor in it.
Huh, that's interesting.
But if it's coming back, there has to be some force involved. You said that this is on a little bit of an incline?
Yeah, a little bit of an incline.
Okay, so in that case, it's just like throwing a ball up in the air. So It goes up the incline, stops.
But if I stop the cart when it's up the incline, it stays there.
That's
it's
because of friction.
It's only if I've pushed it and it's in slight motion that it turns around and comes back.
So if you were to do this with a box, for example, that didn't have wheels, that wobbled, that didn't have that ability to have one fluid motion forward or back, then I think if you shove the box, there would be enough friction that the box would stay and not bounce back towards you. But the fact is, as opposed to pushing the box, kind of patting it and saying, stay here, box, and then walking away, it's not going to move either. But if you make that incline more and more and more upward, eventually the box will be overwhelmed by gravity, and it will start to slide backwards. So I think what you're seeing is do you shop at the same place? Are we talking about pretty much the same place all the time?
Hello, Peggy. Did we lose you again, Peggy? Okay.
Is the incline at the same place?
You're cutting off on me.
We're cutting off. Okay. So
I'm just wondering if maybe you're just right on the cusp of overcoming gravity, and the fact that you have the wheels there allows you to have that backward motion.
Yeah, well, there's a thing not just called friction, but a thing called stiction.
Yeah.
And stiction, what occurs effectively is that if you leave something sit for a period of time, it becomes effectively stickier, if you will.
Okay.
In the same way that if you have a violin bow and you run it across a string, the violin bow hooks the string a little bit and then the string snaps back, which makes the violin work.
Mm.
That's stiction. And if you just put something down and let it sit there on an incline, then it'll have more of a chance to develop this, if you will.
How long does it take to develop stiction?
Very, very little time.
I know my career took probably, I don't know, 10 years to develop that.
That's inertia.
Peggy, thanks for the call. We appreciate
it. 10-year.
Oh, well, there you go. Whoa. You don't get that in radio. It's one
that's
day,
right.
You're out the door, and wow. So long, sucker. Let's go to Steve in Palmer. Steve, you're on.
How you doing? I just had a quick question, then I'll hang up. You hear about space debris and space dust hitting our planet, tons of it at a time. If that's the case, how might these forces be affecting our planet overall? I'll leave it at that. Thank you.
Hey, thanks a lot. Okay, panel.
Boy, this is great stuff today.
Yeah.
Well, overall, it's going to increase the mass slightly.
And it may increase the speed slightly depending on which direction it hits. For example, every time we send a rocket ship up into space, we actually slow the planet down a little bit by the amount of force that it takes to take that rocket ship off the Earth.
But given the size of the Earth,
it's
immeasurably small.
But if we get hit with stuff from the outside, then we will speed up?
So think about holding a basketball that's spinning on your finger and then pushing it in the direction that it's traveling. You're actually going to make it go faster.
Yeah.
Now, try to push it in the other direction. You're going to slow it down.
No, that's a good
point. So all depends on how the matter hits us and comes into our orbit.
You know, I had heard that there was a vast quantity of very tiny meteorite particles that fall all the time on the planet.
And so, you could actually catch them if you take a thing of take a bucket, for example, and put it in your backyard during, for example, a meteor shower, and then take a magnet and put it in a plastic bag and stick it in that water the next day. You can actually pick up some of those particles.
Really?
Yeah.
Yeah, and I was told, although I haven't gotten my kids to do it yet, a good place to fish for them is at the outlet of downspouts from your roof.
Really?
Because you've got all that area that's being then washed and coming and concentrating down.
So we need to try that still at home with putting the magnet in the plastic bag, running it over where the downspout is, and seeing what we pick up.
But all meteorite material is not magnetic, right?
No, a very small portion of it. But, you know, thousands of tons hit our...
But the other dust is you're not going to find very well.
So thousands of tons hit, and we've been being hit by meteors for billions of years. How much mass have we actually gained?
I've seen the calculation before, specifically on the amount of water that's on the planet. Yeah. Because most of the water that's on our planet has come to us on a comet or a comet tail at one point in time. So if you think of all the water that's on this planet, you go back 4 billion years when we first kind of popped up, that's a lot of water.
Yeah,
and we've been told by looking at the moon that the greatest number of hits was early on, and they've been slowing down ever since. So,
we've kind of cleared the field.
Yeah.
Let's take a break. It's 800-348-2551, the Science Forum on WAMC. Back to your calls in a moment.
Support for WAMC comes from the Waldorf School of Saratoga Springs, educating children pre-K through grade 12 and striving to inspire a lifelong love of learning. WaldorfSaratoga.org. Ulster County Resource Recovery Agency, using food scraps and yard waste to create nutrient-rich compost to help conserve water and control weeds. Compost available for purchase, ucrra.org. Schenectady County Historical Society in Schenectady's Historic Stockade District, featuring exhibits, walking tours, research library, and more, now presenting Secret Stockade Walking Tours with Lunch, schenectadyhistorical.org. The Lathrop Communities, serving older adults in the Quaker tradition for 25 years, independent living in Northampton and East Hampton, Massachusetts, in the heart of the Pioneer Valley, lathrop.kendall.org. And Grapes and Grains Wine and Spirits, East Greenbush, New York, specializing in wine and craft spirits for more than 15 years, stocking single malts, bourbons, tequilas, and gins, grapesandgrainswine.com.
Vox Pop on WAMC. Ray Graff here. Boy, it's the Science Forum, and what a rollicking good time we're having today. The number to call is 800-348-2551. Don't look so skeptical, Ed. It's a good time we're having here. This one came in via email from Jamie, and the subject heading is Second Sun. If we moved all the gas giants in our solar system to one place, would it be enough mass for fusion to take place? Could we find more gas locally? Well, if you've heard the show, you know there's plenty of gas to go around. I knew we would be then able to manipulate gravity to do this so it would not matter, but is that enough? So if you got all the gas giants and put them together, is it enough to have enough mass to create fusion?
Well,
I would say
no. According to people much smarter than me, and there's many of them in this room, Jupiter is about 75 times too small to make another sun.
Right.
So you'd have to have 75 times Jupiter. And effectively, if you take all the other planets in the solar system, put them together, you'll have a second Jupiter. So you're still missing 74 times the matter.
You know, there was a piece in the news last week or the week before. I talked to Berman about this last week. There was a very small dwarf sun star, very dim, that had a couple of planets that are in the Goldilocks zone or whatever. Mm-hmm. And the news heading said it's only slightly bigger than Jupiter. And I said, well, how can that possibly be? It needs to be 80 times or 75 times.
The mass, just the mass,
oh,
not the size.
Oh, you make a point. You make a point, Barbara.
It's a fat butt planet, or a fat butt sun. So,
okay, well, let's go back.
You can say that. We're not allowed to.
Let's go back to the phones and go to Bobby in South Glens Falls. Bobby, you're on.
Hey, how are you? I'm afraid mine is a little more mundane question.
Good.
I'm just curious. I go back a few years, and I'm concerned about and wanted to know about the carbon footprint with automobiles and gasoline usage. However, the two things I'm thinking about is that back in the day, when you had a 52 Chevy, you said six-cylinder, you said fill it up with oil and check the gas, and you'd go down the highway and gigantic plumes of blue smoke would be going down the highway. I have to say that of recent, you don't see those big blue smokes pretty much. It's pretty rare today. So the cars are obviously not burning as much oil and better compression. However, that being said, one family generally had one car, like we were in the Poconos, and when that car went back to New York City for the weekend, we thumbed it. Today, you drive past a typical house, and there are four and five, and then, to be quite honest, with broken families, there's like six cars in the driveway. So the two things is the carbon footprint terrible today, or the car's better and it's offsetting all that blue smoke from back in the 50s and those cars that weren't running well?
Well, just let's do, I understand your point. Let's try to get to the blue smoke. So the blue smoke is probably lead and also probably oil. So you don't see carbon dioxide per se come out, but you can assume that for every gallon of gas that you're burning, you're putting out quite a bit of carbon dioxide. Let's just say, you know, that's going to be standard depending on your gas mileage. So 25 mile per gallon car is going to put out the same CO2 regardless. So there's other pollutants, obviously, that we threw into the atmosphere. We're definitely burning more carbon now than we used to. But a lot of it goes down to what we buy. So the transportation costs and the transportation miles that our food comes, that our goods come. Who used to eat strawberries in December in upstate New York? It was not a thing that happened, but now we can get them from Chile. We can pay a buck or two more, but hey, we can have them on our cereal and they're good for us and all that. Those all have to come a significant distance. Suburbs didn't really exist until the advent of the interstate system in the 50s and 60s. So people didn't live 20, 30 miles from their workplace. That just wasn't feasible. I remember when I was a kid, and I'm not that old, that going from Schenectady to Albany down Central Avenue was like an adventure. And now people do it every day. So,
Bobby, thanks a lot for the call.
Yeah, I'm just going to say about the oil and the blue smoke. With the burning the oil, it's not so much all of the additional CO2 from it, because it's a relatively small amount of oil. It's that it doesn't burn very well and generates a lot of soot and pollutants.
One of the things I've heard from Gordon Fricke, who does the automotive show once a month or so, is that now the modern generation of cars are actually burning more oil than they did even 10 or 20 years ago. It's just the way the engines are being designed. And so it's more common that after 1,000 or 2 miles, you'll be down a quart. And it wasn't that way 20 years ago.
Nope. And if you want to have a lot of fun, if you go online, you can check your carbon footprint at any time. And I do that with my students, and they're usually quite shocked at the number of Earths it takes to feed everybody, et cetera.
Yes, I had one student who was happy that it took 10 Earths to sustain a planet full of him.
Wow. Let's go to Mitch in Albany. Mitch, you're on.
Hi, how you doing?
Good.
One of your panelists earlier stated that dark matter neutralizes matter when it comes into contact, and I had seen a report earlier in the month that 96% of the universe is dark matter. How would that ratio, does anything still exist?
Is dark matter the same as antimatter?
No. Dark matter is probably neutrinos, something like that. No, it's a different material.
We don't even know really what it is, right?
Well, the suggestion is that when you take matter and antimatter and you combine them together, they produce neutrinos, which is what people right now think is dark matter.
All right, this one came in via email from Bonnie. The subject heading is Flatulence Experiment, Science Forum. Number one, a person highly prone to flatulence is put in an 8x8x8 sealed cell provided with only beans and water. Which will happen first? He or she passes out due to lack of oxygen or due to cumulative self-produced methane? Two, would the danger change if the cell were a 6-foot cube? This is a person with maybe a little too much time on her hands. But Bonnie, great question.
Well, methane itself isn't particularly toxic, so...
Why are you all looking at me?
Well, somebody's got to answer this question.
I'm not the flatulence goddess here.
Yeah, but wouldn't methane, methane's produced, it'll start locking up the oxygen in the room?
It doesn't lock up.
Doesn't lock it up?
Nope.
Okay.
I would think you'd suffocate
carbon
from that's not really that large of a room. If you think of the requirements necessary to breathe, you're going to run out of oxygen first and go unconscious.
Right.
And then whoever finds your body is in for a
little rude awakening. Whatever you do, just don't light a match in there, Bonnie. And Bonnie, thanks for the call. That was great. The email. Wow.
No homework on this one, Ray.
Yeah,
please.
All right. Let's go to Cookie in Del Mar. Cookie, how are you?
Hi, I'm good, thank you. But I'm wondering about what isn't so good. When you were talking before about the old cars and now the new cars and also the park carbon footprints of people, you know, I was always wondering if it's even possible to measure the amount of damage, that is chemical damage, chemical pollutants in the soil, find out where it is. And in any way, even if you did know that, would it ever be possible to remediate what we've done over, let's say, a couple of centuries? Not just here, but in when I'm thinking about this, I'm thinking about it on a little global scale. Is anybody looking at that, or is it even possible to look at it, given how tiny a soil sample really is in just one area? You can do it, 1,000 of them in an acre, and maybe not even do a good job of finding out what's in there. But it occurs to me there's just an unbelievable amount down there.
Well, the field of science is called environmental toxicology. It certainly does exist. It's existed for 100 years or so, since the Mad Hatters and people getting sick in the workplace. There are college courses. There are research projects galore that measure these toxins, and they tend to fall into categories. So if you look at the major ones, we have the microorganisms, so those things that are pathogenic that cause disease. That is something that we propagate. I mean, yes, you can have naturally occurring pathogens, but generally we transmit them to ourselves. Next one would be heavy metals, and those usually are transported in the environment by burning fossil fuel or by industrial processes. Then there are things like pharmaceuticals and personal care products, the PPCPs of the world, where we excrete the material that our bodies do not consume as we wash our hair, fragrance our clothes, whatever.
Okay.
Then there are inorganics like waste products from manure and weathering of rocks even can create toxins in the soil.
Cookie, thanks a lot for the call. Our number here is 800-348-2551. This one came in from Mark via email at voxpop@wamc.org. Is there really such a thing as quicksand? And if so, is quicksand in real life just as dangerous as it is portrayed in the movies and on TV?
Yeah,
quicksand.
Well, quicksand is effectively sand with too much water in it. That's all it is. And what happens is that as long as the sand and water mixture is stable, nothing happens. But if you start to shake it, what happens is the water gets between the sand grains and separates them enough so that they lose friction between themselves and you can sink into it.
Uh-huh.
And yes, it does exist.
Is it as dangerous as they show on the TV?
It's only dangerous if you fight against it. And if you ever get stuck in quicksand, what you simply do is float to the surface. So you don't. If you try to pull your feet out, for example, what happens is you create a vacuum, and that pulls you down further.
Okay, so how do you get out of it?
You just float.
Well, you float to the surface.
You try to go from vertical to horizontal in some way, very slowly.
Oh, very interesting.
Yeah. Because you actually won't sink particularly far down because of the density of the sand.
Mm.
But if it's over your nose, then you're kind of in trouble.
Okay. That's where the struggling bit comes in.
Right.
Don't struggle.
That will pull you down.
Okay. Well, that was interesting.
And don't run away from a bear.
No?
No.
You sing loudly at a bear, I've heard.
Well, I think you're supposed to not stare at its eyes, but then appear bigger than it. So kind of.
Well, how do you do that?
I look at his belly button. I don't know. I haven't practiced.
So look at his belly button and he'll think you're bigger than.
And then just kind of put your hands up and say, hey, bear, how are you, bear? Nice day, bear.
I don't know how we got to this, but I have heard.
It's all in the same book.
I have heard that you scream or sing very loudly in a high-pitched voice, and they freak out.
Oh, high-pitched voice.
Yeah.
Then the bear thinks it's its mother or its wife and runs away.
Has Neil Sedaka ever been attacked by a bear?
I don't think so.
See?
Let's check.
Exhibit A. Let's go to Jonathan in Greenfield, Mass. Jonathan.
Yeah, hi. So you guys are just a barrel of laughs today.
Oh, thank you.
I got a question for you that's been burning in my brain for over 50 years. And I got to tell you just a very short story first. When I was in the second grade, about 1962, my teacher, Mrs. Thompson, just suddenly started expounding on the subject of fossil fuels. I don't know why. Maybe there was a weekly reader story on the subject at that time. And, you know, it was the basic story that we've all heard, you know, millions of years, dead organic matter, heat and pressure, and it turns into all this stuff that we've been taking out of the earth for, you know, 150 years or so. So my question is, the earth has only been around for about 4.5 billion years. I don't know how long exactly there has been vegetation and dead organic matter to accumulate on the planet in that time, but it seems to me that there hasn't really been enough time to account for the quantity of this stuff that we're still discovering and been pumping out of the earth. So the question is, has there ever been some kind of scientific experiment under control conditions to prove that this conventional theory of the origin of fossil fuels, that it's true?
Well, I can tell you that a lot of it has to do with rivers and the accumulation of plant material.
I can't hear you very well.
Can you hear Ed now?
Can you hear me now?
Yeah, a little bit better.
Right, get a little closer.
Okay, here. How's that? Basically, it has to do with rivers. It has to do with the fact that rivers accumulate, they concentrate plant material at the deltas, for example. And at the delta location, what you have is lots of sand and everything else coming down, which buries the plant material in spot. And very often, rivers form at places where there's a lot of heat underneath, at least early on when the ocean first opens up and the rivers are forming. And so you have heat and you have plant material, and the two of them together is what gives you, for example, oil. Or if you don't have as much heat, you'll wind up compacting the material and getting coal. And yes, there's been a lot of work done on that, and yes, indeed, it appears that plant material is what produces the fossil fuels. Besides the fact that if you go to Pennsylvania and you look at the coal seams, you can actually see the plant material that's still there.
Okay. Well, thanks a lot for the call. But why do they call it fossil fuels if it's plant material? I would think dinosaurs or things like that.
Well, plants become fossils, first of all.
It's annually renewable, but that day set sail a long time ago. So it already annually renewed, and then we're kind of harvesting the fossils of yesteryear instead of cutting down wood and throwing it in the wood stove now.
Right. And the difference between fuel and fossil fuel is the fact that fossil fuels compacted over years, over generations and thousands of years, and so it has much more heat capacity than a regular fuel does.
Okay. 800-348-2551 is our telephone number, 800-348-2551. And let's go over and talk to Joanna in South Hadley, Massachusetts. Joanna.
Hi there. With so many lightning strikes, particularly hitting certain areas of our country, I'm sure other countries too, with Ben Franklin having discovered by getting a shock how many years ago it had traveled down the wire, why can't we set up some contraptions for catching lightning strikes and putting it into a grid for electricity?
Lots of volts, not many amps. The actual amount of energy there is pretty low. I mean, it's very spectacular, but it's pretty localized, and there's not a lot of energy involved here compared to...
So it's a good show, but not a lot of energy.
Yeah, I mean, compared to harvesting it and feeding it into the grid.
So you couldn't feed a capacitor slowly over a long period of time?
Well, you could, but considering the investment that it would take to get it, to capture the lightning, to store the energy and to let it out in a controlled way, the output of that is negligible.
Okay.
Yeah, if you want to think about it simply, when you're sliding over a seat in your car and then you touch a piece of metal, you're producing a lightning strike.
Well, that's true.
Right? So you got a lot of voltage there, but fortunately not a lot of amperage. If there was, you'd be in big trouble.
So there you go, Joanna. Thanks for the call.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. 800-348-2551 is our telephone number. It's the Science Forum. Let's go to Eugene in Warwick. Eugene, you're on.
Well, hey, if the Earth was spinning faster in the past, would gravity have been less, and therefore animals could grow bigger?
Ooh, that's interesting. So, well,
gravity.
Gravity isn't necessarily why animals grow as big or as small. Multicellular animals, anyway. That really has to do with oxygen demand. So, how much oxygen our tissues need, and of course, how many calories we need to undergo cellular respiration, making that ATP stuff. I mean, gosh, that sounds strictly biology, doesn't it?
Well, but from geology, if I may.
Yes.
The spinning Earth has
non-living
the spinning
things.
Of the Earth does not produce gravity. It's the mass of the Earth, and the mass of the Earth hasn't changed very much. So even if it spun faster, there'd be no reason to have larger animals, unless it was spinning so fast that their heads were spinning off their bodies.
But the spinning creates centrifugal force,
right?
So that in a faster spinning planet, you would in fact weigh a tiny bit less, but I think it's negligible.
Oh, very interesting. Well, what great questions today.
It's funny because some planets don't spin hardly at all. Others spin the other way. We think our way is the right way, so to speak. So it's really cool because we don't all of our planets don't just kind of sit there and process in the same way.
Hey, Eugene, we got to take a break here, but thank you for another good call here and some interesting ones today. 800-348-2551 is the number. Ed, Jim, Barbara are here. They're the panel. They're the scientists. I'm the radio host who doesn't know much of anything. We'll be right back.
Support for WAMC comes from the Henyon Bakery, Amherst. Since 1993, offering hearth-baked whole grain breads, pastries, birthday, wedding, and special occasion cakes, as well as gluten-free offerings. HenyonBakery.com. The Ashokan Center, environmental education for schools, plus music, crafts, and outdoor experiences for all, where nature inspires. AshokanCenter.org. Waterwheel Village, Galway, New York. A country store since 1923, offering aged cheddar cheeses, nostalgic candies, New York products and gifts, waterwheelvillage.com. And Colby Attorney's Service, corporate formations, document retrieval services, court filings, and legal publishing for the legal and professional community. Since 1939, colbyservice.com. And Autobot Service, Great Barrington, Massachusetts, offering service, repair, and diagnosis of Asian-made and imports, specializing in late-model Volkswagen, Subaru, Audi, and BMW. AutobotTechnic.com.
Vox Pop on WAMC. Ray Graff here. 800-348-2551 is the telephone number, or voxpop@wamc.org is the email address. This one came in via email from David, who says, regarding Earth accumulating mass from space debris, Dave Barry wrote a column a while ago explaining that Earth's gravity also increased with its mass, which explains why we all weigh more than we did 30 or 40 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
You see?
I was wondering why that was.
That's the answer. Let's
go. You learned something? Every day.
Let's go to Tony in Schenectady. Tony, you're on.
Yeah, listen, I have these really nice house plants in my apartment that are doing actually really well right now.
Okay.
But I was curious, how many of these house plants are left to grind up and pressurize in order to get a gallon of gasoline?
All right, that's a fair question.
How much money and energy do you have, Tony?
How much time do you have?
In terms of mass, if you were converting everything with 100% efficiency, it would take about 2 pounds of plant dry matter to make 1 pound of gasoline.
Oh, that's worth it. Roughly speaking. You got a couple of billion years, you're all set.
You know, all you need is a lot of heat.
300 million,
pressure.
Really, right? It only takes hundreds of millions.
Yeah,
oh,
that's fine.
At the same time, I mean, we're taking algae and turning it into oil, so.
Now, can you artificially accelerate that process and do it in the lab? I know it would not be an energy, a net gain, but could you do it?
Yeah, all you need is heat and pressure. It's doable, but the problem being that the heat and pressure eats up all of your energy that you get out.
Tony, thanks a lot for that great call. Let's go to Pete in Albany. Pete, you're on.
Good afternoon, panel. My question is about the moon rotating around the Earth. Does it go in the same direction as the Earth's rotation?
Yes, it does. That was easy.
Okay, that's all I wanted to know. Thank you very much, panel.
Okay. Anybody want to expound on that?
think Ed would like to.
Do I have to?
No, you don't have to, Ed.
Well, the
moon. You will anyway.
The moon, the Earth goes around. The moon goes around the Earth, but the moon itself only takes spins once on its axis for every time around the Earth.
Realize that.
So it's like a little box of dancing ballerinas, and then one's in the center,
what?
And then the other one goes around it, and always the same face is facing the center ballerina.
Right, and we know that because we only see one side of the moon. And so as the moon goes around the Earth, it has to be spinning on its axis once.
Oh, yeah. Okay, right? But it doesn't look like a ballerina. It looks like Jackie Gleason.
Well, that's true.
Actually, it looks like a rabbit, according to the Chinese.
Well, there you go.
Rabbit.
Thanks, Ed. Boy, we're really off the rails again.
So the dark side of the moon isn't dark. It's just we don't see it.
Right.
So we assume it must be boring and
but
dark.
But when the side we see is light, is dark, then the dark side of the moon is light.
Correct.
Well, let's go to Alan in Hudson. Alan, you're on.
Hi, I'm here. You there?
Yeah, you're there.
Yeah, I had a quick question, then I'm going to hang up.
Okay.
I have a question about mold. If it occurs in my refrigerator at a low temperature, in a field environment, out in the forest or the rainforest, why doesn't it take over the world? What stops it from expanding to a degree that we'd see it everywhere?
Well, a couple of things. Sunlight. Molds really don't like UV light. They don't like light. They're not protected from it. They're supposed to be in all the kind of cracks and crevices. Think about your feet, guys. The reason why we have foot mold is because they're kind of dark and warm and moist.
We have foot mold?
Yeah. You know, athlete's foot.
Oh, I see. Yeah. I see. Okay.
So you don't get athlete's knee. You get athlete's foot. So
okay.
The light really does a great job keeping the mold from getting out of control.
Yeah. It has sort of taken over. It's just underneath the surface.
Yeah, it's in the soil.
And you can't see it. But there's a lot of fungus out there.
Well, thanks for that one. 800-348-2551 is our telephone number. And Brian in Red Hook, it's your turn. Brian.
Hi. I was just wondering, if you had a match, a single wooden match in an 8x8 room filled with oxygen, and you lit the match, what would happen?
Ow. Thank heavens it's oxygen.
The match will burn very brightly and very quickly.
But the room will not explode, correct?
No.
Why don't you talk about the gummy bears?
Because oxygen just aids combustion. It does not burn.
Well, it's chemically part of combustion, but you need the fuel. And once you've used up the fuel of the match, the fire goes out.
But don't they use liquid oxygen for rocket fuel?
Well, yeah, but then...
But they mix it with hydrogen and other things.
Hydrogen or kerosene or something.
Yeah. And you want to keep the match out of your hand, actually, when you do that.
Yes,
because you are fuel as well.
Yes.
Because it just takes the long-burning match, it makes it a very short-burning match, and all that energy is released at once instead of over a long-ish period of time.
So you will burn then? So is this where spontaneous human combustion comes from?
Oh, gosh. I hope not.
No. Okay.
No. I mean, we do this on small scale in the chemistry laboratory. You put electricity into water, and you split water into hydrogen and oxygen, and you collect them in little test tubes upside down. And then you take the match, and you light it, and you stick it up in the oxygen one, and it burns really brightly, and everyone goes ooh and ah, and then it goes out, and then we all go on to the next experiment.
Well, you wanted to say something else? Brian?
Well, people will say that, he had an oxygen tank and that exploded. And that's not really true, is it?
No, it would be a matter that if the oxygen tank leaks, then it will support combustion of the fuel around it much better.
Just like an acetylene tank would. If you're fueling it under pressure, plus you have a carbon source, then it's going to burn very, very hot.
Yeah, an example An unfortunate example of this was when Apollo 1 burned.
Yeah.
They were doing a test, and...
It was an oxygen environment.
It was in a pure oxygen environment, which it was normally would be in space, but rather than being at 4 psi, it was at full atmospheric pressure. Something sparked, and the whole thing went up in seconds.
All right, let's go to Tim in Poughkeepsie. Tim, you're on the science forum.
Hey, how are you doing today?
Good.
Good. So I have a question about where the energy comes from for electrons to spin on their own axis as well as around the nucleus.
Okay. Well, Tim, I have to disappoint you. They don't actually spin around a nucleus. They don't go in a circle like a carousel. We're all taught that in school, but it ain't true. So
really,
quantum mechanics has proven that pretty definitively, that we can kind of know where it is. And if we know kind of where it is, we don't know where it's heading. And if we know where it's heading, then we don't know where it is at any one moment. And that's the Heisenberg uncertainty principle. So the figure that everyone shows, like even on the Big Bang Theory, where you have those tracks going around a nucleus, that's all hogwash.
And
how about them spinning on their own axes? Is that accurate?
Well, in terms of you don't need energy to keep it going. Again, from quantum mechanics, the energy can change only in certain jumps. So as long as it doesn't have that jump of readily available to it, it will just stay in that energy state forever.
And anything above what we call absolute zero, which is negative 273 Celsius, has ambient energy just from that thermal condition being hot.
Okay, so it's thermal energy that's causing
the
electrons move.
The spin of the electrons and the movement of the electrons have nothing to do with thermal energy.
But everything moves.
Well, that's vibrational,
right,
or rotational. But the electron motion is exactly the same at absolute zero.
Well, yeah, it turns out that the so-called electron that spins, it's a quantum spin. It's a way to tell one electron from another when they're the same energy. It's like to say, oh, you're Tweedledum and this one's Tweedledee. And yes, you look identical, but you're not exactly identical. So they don't actually spin. It's so disappointing. They don't go around the nucleus in a circle, and they don't spin on their axis
like a
top.
They just are?
No, they just are.
Well, that's disturbing.
And then they're not.
Tim, thank you very much for the call. We appreciate
it. Sorry, quantum mechanics is difficult to explain.
Did you think that we would be talking quantum mechanics here on the Science
Forum? We started talking Heisenberg before you turned the mics on earlier.
Oh, I'm sure of it.
Yeah.
All right, let's go to Kyle in Petersburg. Kyle, you're on.
Hey, what's going on?
Well, you've heard it.
Hey, I have an idea there. Like, what if the Earth, the inside of the oil, and the release of gas or pressure, what if that's like a car engine radiator? You know, your radiator, your engine will overheat without fluid in it, and it needs the expulsion of gas as well. So,
okay, talking about removing the oil and gas from the Earth would do something bad.
Take too much oil out, we're going to overheat too rapidly.
Well, the oil and gas really don't regulate the temperature, there's always heat energy coming out through the Earth because of radioactivity deep in.
I'm gonna hang up.
The actual amount of oil and gas that's there is really extremely small compared to the mass of the Earth. So even if it did have a role in doing it, it's insignificantly small compared with all the other rock that's around.
Yeah, it's localized though. So that if you remove too much oil and gas from a location, the ground actually sinks.
Yeah.
For example, Dallas, Texas has dropped about, or Houston has dropped about 50 or 60 feet since they started removing oil and gas from beneath it.
Did you see the piece in the news last week, I think it was, about they're trying to explain why there are so many more earthquakes in parts of the U.S., southern U.S. and whatnot, and they said it's the mantle falling into the earth in spots where it's very thin? Did you see that?
The reason there are more earthquakes is deep well injection.
No,
wastewater.
I understand that, but there is some science, and I wish I had it in front of me. I don't, but part of the crust going in or the mantle itself?
Well, the crust is extremely thin.
In spots,
and on top of it, not so much in the south, but in the north, we also had a huge ice sheet that depressed it, and it's rising up since the ice sheet's been gone. So a lot of earthquakes around here, for example, are related to the earth actually rising up.
Moving up.
We call it isostatic equilibrium.
Let's go to Joe in Coxsackie. Joe.
Hi. I'd like to answer the question to why we always see the man in the moon. And the answer is because the moon is not spherical, it's oblong, and the heavy side is the man in the moon. So because of the Earth's gravity, it's always facing us.
Yes. The moon probably was spinning in the past. But as the moon spun, the surface of the moon was actually pulled towards the Earth, sort of like the waves, the waves of the ocean move with the moon going overhead. And the amount of friction associated with that is so huge that it forced the moon to stop spinning. Mm. And that's why we always see the same side. We get the same thing on the Earth. When the moon is directly overhead, the Earth's surface actually rises about 6 or 7 inches below it. But the Earth is so much heavier, so much more mass, that it's still spinning. So the Earth is actually slowed down as a result of that.
But this oblong effect on the moon is very small compared to the size of the moon.
Right.
Joe,
thanks a lot.
It's not like it's egg-shaped or anything.
So then a very small body, let's say Mercury, is locked all the time because the sun is so close and
it's so huge? It's tidally locked.
Interesting. And so they talked about this very dim, very small dwarf star that has these planets, and they said they are also locked.
Mm-hmm.
And there will be spots that are very cold and spots mm-hmm. that are very warm, and there might be a spot in the middle that might have a...
Yeah, almost every satellite in the solar system is tidally locked.
Unless they're recently captured. So one of the reasons why we go and look at these asteroids is to kind of get a feel as to how long they've been congealed together, these asteroid belts.
It's the Science Forum on WAMC. Over to Galloway in Albany. You're on.
Thank you very much. I have a question. With all the expanded space travel, Elon Musk with SpaceX, and talk of getting astronauts to Mars, is there any viable solution for the space junk encircling the planet? I just wanted to get your feedback on that. I'll hang up and listen to your answer.
Thanks a lot.
Well, you can actually go online, and there are websites that show you where all the space junk is, and it's actually quite frightening.
Down to what size?
Oh,
nuts and bolts.
Nuts and
really?
Bolts. Yeah, because if they hit a rocket ship,
17,000 miles an hour.
Yeah, they can do grave damage.
Are they confident they have all of it logged?
Well, as much as they have, but the problem is, of course, that some of it goes into the atmosphere and it falls down, but the vast majority of it stays up there and we can't do much about it.
And it's funny because most of it is in the geosynchronous orbit, the orbit that's prime, that we want to use for satellites
right.
and other communication devices, but that's the most crowded. So we've created a freeway that's clogged kind of just through desire of wanting to be in these bands. And it just makes it even harder to get a satellite there and to keep it there. And then if something happens and that satellite hits space junk, then it becomes space junk and we just propagate the problem.
Yeah.
So I think the question really is there a way that we can go up there and hoover all that crap up? And it would be an awfully expensive endeavor, but it would do a service.
That's artfully put.
Yeah.
Hoover all that crap up. Yeah. Well, it's very scientific. All right, let's go to Jackson in Oneonta. Jackson, you're on.
Hi, how are you doing?
Good.
Good. I'm calling in for me and my friend Ed. We've got a question about blood vessel outgrowth or the spacing between capillary vessels. So he's studying for A&P, I'm studying for biochemistry. And we're wondering whether do capillary vessels contact like every cell in the tissues, or is it mostly is there a spacing between the capillary vessels such that like oxygen can like diffuse across between cells and like reach them?
They're very much leaky, but they're not necessarily leaky to the level of a red blood cell being able to escape. But they are leaky enough for gases to diffuse, and certainly the lymph system, is built on the idea that everything is leaky, and it's leaky on a purpose. Because you do need
purpose.
Yeah, you do need to get oxygen to okay. every surface.
So just a follow-up question. Do you know, like, what determines that? Is it cell signaling mediated, or is it just cells that are too far away from a capillary vessel just don't grow?
Well, that's a really difficult one on the air.
Yeah.
I really want a whiteboard.
I'll ask my professor.
It's cell mediated. It's developmental.
Right.
It's self-limiting in that you need to be able to respire. You don't want high carbon dioxide levels. If you have long carbon dioxide concentrations, you're not going to mitotically divide.
Okay. Well, listen, Jackson, that was a very good question. And we're now done with the program. We can't really top that one. And I have no idea what was just
said. Can we talk about it for a while after the show?
Yeah, you guys can. I'm out of here. Hey, thank you all for being here. We appreciate it. Support comes from Harold's Ice Cream, Thorne's Marketplace, downtown Northampton, Massachusetts. Over 300 flavors of handcrafted dairy and dairy-free ice creams, cakes, hot fudge, and more. Harold's.com. Stories Nursery, Freehold, New York, featuring an assortment of plants, flowers, trees, shrubs, and garden supplies Monday through Sunday, 8 to 5, a gardener's destination, storiesnursery.com. Interactive Media Consulting, Saratoga Springs, New York, providing logo and print design, web development, and digital marketing throughout the capital region and beyond, marketing creative and business ideas since 1996, imediaconsult.com. And Viva Fresh Pasta, 30 years and 30 wines by the glass, European cuisine infused with flavors of the world, Northampton, Massachusetts. Grab life by the knife and fork. VivaFreshPasta.com. Thanks again to Jim, Ed, and Barbara for being here. Thanks for listening. Thanks to Zach Malloy, our engineer. Your phones were answered again by Dina Salzman from the front office, who's been doing yeoman's labor here answering the calls. Great job. I'm Ray Graff. Tomorrow we bring you a delicious food Friday. We'll talk about the wines of New York with a meteorologist. I'll explain that tomorrow.